From the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, this is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome. Welcome to Wharton Moneyball. Welcome to a full hour of sports analytics here on SiriusXM, Wharton's Business Radio on SiriusXM. This is Cade Massey hosting this week with my longtime co-host, collaborators, friends, faculty colleagues, Audie Weiner and Shane Jensen. Our fourth co-host, Eric Bradlow, is out and about doing Eric Bradlow things. He will be back. Some combination of us are here almost every week of the year and have been for 10 years now. On occasion, we are together in person in studio, as we were for years in the beginning, pre-pandemic, the pre-pandemic times, the before times. This was regular. Now it's less regular, but it is so delightful to be on campus, in the studios, on glorious Locust Walk on a not-so-glorious April morning afternoon. This is Tuesday afternoon, as a matter of fact, not morning. We are recording Tuesday afternoon. Show will go up tomorrow morning, Wednesday. SiriusXM runs early, gets replayed a few times. We'll get the podcast up tomorrow as well. We love to hear from you guys. Give us your reactions to those shows. Best way to reach out to us probably is Twitter. At WMoneyball is our handle there, at WMoneyball. We follow all of our guests. We tweet about them and about the world of sports and sports analytics. We love to hear your feedback, pro, con, suggestions, whatever you got. We have a typical show this week in that we are open lines, open topics for the first half show, and then we roll into an interview with Dean Oliver, longtime friend of the show, basketball savant, Dean Oliver. Fun conversation with him in the second half of the show. Between now and then, we got, I don't know, 15, 16, 17 minutes. I'm guessing the topic of the day, given the company I'm keeping this afternoon, I'm going to guess it's not only baseball, but a sweep that happened in the first series of the season.
Oh, man, that was such a good intro. Yes, I have caught all five of the Yankees' first five games of the season, and the first four against the Astros, resulting in a sweep, was a lot of fun. It just struck me that these big stars, Judge, Stanton, home run hitting, disappeared, and the Yankees are winning it the old-fashioned way. I feel like Willie Randolph's coming in to say, hey, that's our style. What's going on? You know, singles, doubles.
See, what you gotta do is get the other team's bullpen to implode every time, and you'll win.
It's not, but, you know, it's interesting because, they haven't, like, blown it out against them. They've scraped the runs. I mean, Hader, who's a star for Astros as a closer, it was scrappy. Singles, extra bases. It's not like...
Yeah, I've just sworn the Houston series, I think I saw something like the starters had like a two ERA, yeah. And like the bullpen had an over 8 ERA, so it's like...
Right, but it wasn't as if they were like teeing off. It was, that's the old style, crappy reliever comes in and then you just beat them up. They were getting hits, and they were scoring, so obviously their earned run average was high. A couple runs over a couple innings, it does that. But it just didn't feel like it was that the Astros fell apart. You're getting contributions from young guys, and that's what the Yankees never had in the past. Will it hold up? I don't know. As you like to point out, we overreact like hell in the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
We take everything and,
it's a fun part of the year for that. You can, like, is Mookie Betts going to hit over 500 for the season? Probably not.
So, hold on. I want to talk about Mookie Betts, but first, I know that if Eric were here, he would ask the following. He'd say, okay, so obviously your whatever win totals forecast you had for the Yankees before season
90,
so
maybe.
Let's call it 90. Now you probably expected two of the four against the Astros. You got four, so you got your plus two now. Mm-hmm. Just by dint of what happened.
See, I'm at 92. Eric's at 96.
Okay, this 98. This is the question. This is I answered the question before I ask it. Does it change your forecast about the underlying team? Set aside the Astros, just the Yankees. Does it change your forecast about the Yankees that you saw them win the first
game? Yeah, like games? Given that you had them on a 90-win pace prior to this, do you still kind of have them on a 90-win pace?
I do.
Yeah.
I
personally would, too. I think you
kind of... There's no signal in four games, right?
Nothing. No, it was a lot of fun.
No, again,
I enjoyed them.
Credit to, I'll play Eric's role. Those four... five games are in the bank. I mean, they are obviously predictive of your season ending
two out of four. They won their first five. They also won last night in Arizona. I'm giving them three extra wins on their 90.
Yeah,
two and a half.
Yeah.
Well, all right. So now let's talk about Mookie Betts. One, let me ask a really stupid question. Okay, y'all don't judge me too harshly. I thought he played outfield.
He's all over the place, man. I mean, yes, his natural with the Red Sox in his early career was mostly outfield, though he did play a lot of second base even with the Red Sox. But he can basically do like the middle infield positions as well. In
but
addition to being the best painter,
now, right?
Yeah, he plays shortstop. He also, I don't know if you knew this about Mookie Betts. He is a professional bowler. Like he's bowled perfect games many times.
He's a professional bowler.
He's a professional bowler.
Hold on a second.
Well, yeah.
I'm pretty sure that Shane just said he's a professional bowler, but yes. I'm worried that I didn't catch that.
Is yeah,
that
that's right.
I thought he said
he's a professional bowler.
This is bull fighter? Wait.
This is going to reveal where I come from. I thought he said bull rider.
Oh!
I literally thought he said
honestly, if he tried it, he'd probably do it really well.
He would.
He's also a professional bowler. He's a little tall for a bull rider.
But it's interesting. I mean, you move him from right field to shortstop, and his WAR is going to fly because it's built into the system. If he can play that position well or decently, doesn't have to play it well.
He hits well for a shortstop,
unbelievably. And there's a big bonus. And this is one of my
he's usually playing kind of the more defensive outfield positions when he does play outfield. So I don't think it's going to be as extreme.
No, but right field is a big. I mean, the way it ranks by position, shortstop number one in terms of the defensive value. And the way they do it, it's a strange.
Okay, hold on. Let me just tell you what I think I'm hearing. You're saying part of a guy's WAR is how much above expectation he contributes offensively for the position he plays, and that's different dramatically for positions. And he's been playing outfield where guys usually can hit some, and now he's moving to shortstop where guys usually can't hit very well, and yet he hits spectacularly.
Okay, so I would love it if that's actually how it happened, but that's not how they work it.
Okay.
It's not done that way. Hitting is valued separately, and defense is valued separately, and they have this movement. They move WAR from depending on your position. It's a bizarreness. We can talk about it. I don't like that strategy. I think it's weird. Okay. And so what they do is they judge how many defensive runs you've earned or saved or UZR metric, some defensive metric, and they do that at your position. And then you get evaluated for that. But then you get this bonus or subtraction depending on what position you're in. And so shortstop gets the biggest bonus. And right field is kind of in the middle.
But that's not just based on versus expectation?
I'm not sure how they calculate
it.
It
is. It's based on the definition of a replacement at that position.
Yeah, but it's a strange movement. They say, okay, if you're typically the best athlete, the best fielder is at shortstop. And they say, if you were out in right field, this is how much better you would be than the other right fielders. And it's a weird calculation. It's worthy of unpacking. We should probably bring out someone.
I mean, it's worth noting also that Mookie Betts is like, if you just look at offensive WAR,
yeah, he's amazing.
He is like, you know, I mean, like his defense is a very small part of his WAR contribution. He's, I think, the second best WAR in majors.
But what I'm going to say now, just by moving him to shortstop, if he plays it at average and doesn't go terrible at it, he's going to have a big bump in his WAR.
But that doesn't seem crazy to me because his contribution to his team
is
meaningful.
He's replacing a position where he's replacing a worse hitter, basically.
Which it means that.
Yeah.
But that's not how it works. I wish that's how it worked. It's not how it works. It's not.
I would say, like, you know, to any rounding error, it's kind of how it works. Yeah.
Okay.
It's
more
not done by looking at the value.
It's
at that
not
position.
Done that way, but the consequences a little bit.
A little bit is that. I mean, so catchers held out sort of separately. They don't do that. They basically say you're a catcher and you're nothing else.
Yeah.
Which, of course, is not exactly true. But it's an awkward system.
That's odd.
Yes. But, you know, so the priority, of course, is shortstop. Then it goes to center field. Then I believe it's second base, third base.
You're working backwards from offensive expectation.
In terms of, well, it sounds like that, yes.
Lowest expectation.
It's right.
Yeah.
It's also fielding difficulty. They're almost perfectly correlated.
Almost perfectly correlated. Okay. Tell me what else is going on around the world. So Mookie and the Yankees. Those are very reasonably the top stories. What else around the league?
Pirates are 5-0.
Are they really?
Tigers are either 5-0 or 4-1.
It's fun. I mean, and that's kind of part of the thing. What I would love is any central team in either league to be exciting enough. Like, get me hyped about any central team.
Remind us who the central teams are. Give us a rundown.
List them all. I mean, I'm not sure I can remember.
It's not a task.
KC.
So let's just say the AL Central and the NL Central, the last few seasons, has not contributed that
many.
Is
the NL Central Chicago, St. Louis, Milwaukee even?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Milwaukee's good.
They've been winning
again,
the Central, but they haven't
about
been,
a team.
No, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm kind of struggling. Like, I think You know, I think I would like – I mean, obviously the Texan teams, but they actually play in the West, are really good. But I think right now we've kind of got like a dearth of really good teams in the middle of the country other than the Texas teams.
Okay. You're saying you're tired of all the attention on the AL
East? Or, I mean, you know, it's kind of like I'm tired of my own focus. You know, it's because it's like my – you know, I'm usually focused on the AL East, but the Red Sox are the worst team in that. So I'm like, oh, well, where are my favorite where are my favorite players all playing? Well, my two favorite players in baseball now play for the Dodgers, so I could get into them.
Oh,
but
no.
I mean,
don't all the good players play for the Dodgers?
Yes. Well, I mean, it's easy for your favorite players to be on the Dodgers. Mine are, so, but that doesn't help. I mean,
besides Betts?
Shohei, obviously.
Oh, obviously. Yeah. Right.
Well, listen.
Well, thank God he's not with the Angels anymore.
I know. Well,
no, I mean, I'm happy.
Poor Trout.
Yeah, Trout.
He has three home runs.
Four.
He hit one like 480 feet the other day. He keeps reminding us how awesome he is.
Yeah.
And nobody seems to care.
Well, it was the same.
We do care. He's going to be a first bracket Hall of Fame. He's going
to
be.
On a team that just never goes to the postseason.
Wasn't it like opening game? Didn't he home run in his first at bat?
Yeah.
And then nobody else did anything for the rest of the game.
I'm not sure anybody else on his team had a hit that game, for example.
I mean, it's comedy at some point. But didn't he make some decision?
Yeah, I mean, he's basically – I mean, he could. I mean, certainly he's not actively tried to seek out.
Why is that?
Well, I think he just wants to continue to be awesome at baseball. In Los Angeles.
As an individual player, just going to – not bother with the playoffs, don't worry about the
wins.
Well,
again, you know, for most of baseball history, like Ted Williams, like, didn't get to play in the playoffs very often either. Like,
bothered him a lot. I mean, the guy was upset about it, at least.
Right.
They only had two division winners in each league or whatever the heck.
Yeah, I mean, how many Hall of Famers? There are a multitude of Hall of Famers without any more.
The playoff structure was completely different now.
Yeah, but even more recently, there's a lot of players languishing on bad teams. I mean, you're asking, why aren't they? Is it more like the NBA where they just make noise until they're in a better situation?
Okay.
Why don't we have more super team type situations?
Well, that's the extreme in the other direction.
Okay,
so fair enough. No, I'm just selfishly saying
you'd love to see him on.
Yeah,
not if it's the Yankees though, right? I mean, I'd rather have him. I'd rather have
he needs to play for the
California.
Phillies. He's from frickin' suburban Philadelphia.
That would be nice.
Baltimore. Yeah.
Technically not really the need the Phillies have for this season, but I mean, I would
Everybody has a need for Mike Trout.
He'd be useful. He'd be useful in the Phillies. Not gonna lie.
He could probably play shortstop, too, speaking of it.
If he could close the games out, he'd be extra useful for the Phillies.
I wish they would do – maybe there should be a promotion game weekend where they moved players out of their normal position and played them in other positions.
Oh, that'd be so fun.
I love this Mookie Betts' shortstop
thing. Why don't we do the All-Star game that way? Take all the best players in position and be like in the All-Star. And then just randomize the position at the start of the game.
Random would be great.
So
the
fun.
The lottery catcher. No, 100%.
No, that's a dangerous
100%
position.
100%.
Garrett Cole, your catcher this game. See how it feels. See how it feels to catch that. Yeah. Pitchers are included in this, too. So you just randomize a catcher to be the pitcher. Be great.
That's right. We see some second baseman out there on the mound, you know?
Yeah. No, this is I think we're all going to remember where we were when we came up with this idea. I think we're getting pretty close to basketball? We're getting pretty close to basketball, I think, in our design here.
That would actually be an interesting where basically you get nine players to put on the field and your opponent gets to put them places.
Even better.
Oh, I love that. You got to go pairwise?
Yeah,
like,
you got to take turns?
Dude, I mean, I watch the selection show.
This is good for at least one game a year, right?
Yeah,
is that asking that much?
No, and I mean, I kind of feel like, you know, the All-Star game, we're already kind of struggling to make that kind of interesting, exciting. I mean,
yeah.
I think you could only really do this in an exhibition standpoint, to start at least.
Mm-hmm. But imagine if you had to do that. Put a roster together, you're going to have nine guys, and you have to put the most versatile team on the field because your opponent's going to decide
where
they go.
The guys would like to do it. The guys would like playing a different position. They would like showing off their range, their skill.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, some teams have. I mean, there's been this increased value in players that can play multiple
positions.
No,
that super utility, I think, has. I mean, because most of the superstars are not like Mookie Betts, where you can just kind of throw them in anywhere. Like Whit Merrifield, I think, is the one the Phillies have now that's kind of the super utility. I remember Brock Holt was one the Red Sox had back a few years ago.
TJ LeMay, who plays everything. You know, also, it shows you the value of Ohtani, not this year because he can't pitch, but the rosters are so small on the hitter side. They're 13 on the pitchers, which means that having an extra hitter is amazing. You could fill in your starter and a hitter. It's an extra spot. Mm-hmm. It's a full-on extra roster spot. And that's valuable to have one because you use your bullpen so extensively, and it leaves you so shorthanded as and with extra batters. And the it's just a he's adding value right just with that.
One of the rule changes they were considering, was it not, a new restriction on the number of pitchers you could carry. So you're saying they're carrying half the roster, 12 or 13 guys on the pitching staff. They were thinking about shortening that because right now they're able to just move the guys around so much, bring them in for a couple of batters.
They have also restricted. I wouldn't be able to list off the exact rules, but they have restricted it so that pitchers have to face a certain number of batters.
This
and
is
stuff
where
like
I was
that.
Going. What
it's
rules?
Three.
This time last year, we were all spun up about the new rules. What rules should we be paying attention to, or what rules are relevant, or what rules are still kind of playing out the ramifications in baseball?
Well, one I've seen sort of that controversial is I think they've really restricted how you can slide into second base in a way, like blocking the base now. And this is all just obviously about injury prevention. But they've done it in such a way that, you know, it's you really have to, as a defender, not block the base at all when somebody's trying to steal with, like, your foot or your body or something like that. And there's been certain ones that have been ruled.
The purist
head. I'm shaking my head because of very fond memories of so many stars, you know, Reggie Jackson.
Spikes
football
up.
Reggie Jackson taking out the shortstop. Yeah. The plays at the plate where the catchers would block the plate.
Catchers can't block the plate?
Oh, they cannot.
Well, that's actually been a rule for a while now.
Really?
Catchers can't block the plate. You can't have those giant collisions anymore.
No more collisions. You got to avoid them. I'm not sure what new is for this year.
Well, it's the blocking at second. The plate as well.
The real issue with the pitchers and is that it just is excessive. It's boring to have these pitchers come in and out. They pitch so impressively for such a small number of pitches, the game just lacks that excitement.
I think they keep changing the rules to try and reduce this, but I think it's, I don't know if we're really going to be able to turn back the play. I think we've kind of lost the marquee matchup side on the pitching side.
You mean the two great starters going against each other for
in the baseball,
seven
the
innings.
Future will still be about how the hitters do against, but it'll be, you know, how our hitters are doing against this, like, you know, like 10 pitchers per game, right. You know, each an inning piece. That's what I fear, is that we're losing that kind of marquee matchup on the pitching side, on the starting pitching side.
All right. Well, gentlemen, that has what we can do here in the first half of the show. We've got another half to go. We have Dean Oliver, longtime friend of the show, talking basketball coming up after the break. But thank you guys for listening. Come back and join us after the break.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball. Welcome back to 1 hour Sports Analytics here on SiriusXM. We are in studio this week and enjoying being in studio. That's Dion Simpkins bringing us up out of the bottom of the hour with his music. Such a delight. We don't get that when we're on Zoom. Good to be in here with the boys, with the bosses, and now with our guests. This, as most of you know, is our guest part of the show. We are delighted to welcome back to the show for the umpteenth time, Dean Oliver, longtime friend of the show, going way back to the beginning of the show, I would say. Dean, one of the best known and one of the pioneering men in analytics of basketball, the author of Basketball on Paper, an influential book in the whole world of basketball analytics, Basketball on Paper 2004. He is, I'm assuming it's a kind of update. He's got another book coming out probably this fall. He says his work with it is mostly done. Basketball Beyond Paper. He wrote Basketball on Paper 2004. Basketball Beyond Paper. We'll hear a little bit about that. Dean Oliver has been beyond basketball analytics. He was responsible for the original good models at ESPN for power rankings in football, for example. He's worked with teams, multiple teams, most recently with the Washington Wizards. Not Bullets. The guys are telling me they're not the Bullets anymore. They're the Washington Wizards. The Washington Wizards. He parted ways, I don't know, about a book ago with the Washington Wizards. We'll hear about that. But Dean, it's always good to see you. Thanks for making time for us.
Good to be here. When did you guys start? You say I've been here for the umpteenth time, but since when? When was that?
10 years, man. We just cleared our 10th year anniversary. March 2014. That was the beginning of Business Radio, Wharton Business Radio. And we were one of the original shows. We're one of only like two original shows that are still surviving. And we're all intact, the same four co-hosts the whole time. So we're hanging in there, Dean. How about you, man? How about you?
Oh, doing great. Yeah, it's a fun time. Basketball is high on the priority list of watching these days, both the NBA and college basketball.
Well, let's
not just men's college basketball too. Wins is great too.
Well, I do want to stretch you beyond your typical professional basketball expertise, which we'll come back to. But we are, of course, just rolling into the Final Fours. Men's Final Four was set over the weekend, and women's Final Four set as of last night. And it's been great fun, as it always is. I think the women's probably have never received more attention than the. Has anybody seen the numbers, Matt? Do you have the numbers yet on the TV last night? My God, Iowa LSU was not a final. It was last year's final. It was a whatever, an eight team. Is it a quarterfinal? That's a quarterfinal.
Elite Eight, I guess, round, right?
And it was spectacular. But so, Dean, I'm just curious, how do you consume college basketball, and to what extent do you have your analytic lens on in there when you're doing so? How do you tell us where you are in college basketball these days, both on the men's and the women's side?
I'm frankly catching up, because over the last 4 years, being on the coaching side, I really couldn't watch a lot of college basketball. When you're in the NBA, it's like you have no time. Your season overlaps with the tournament, so you basically can watch one or two games here and there. Mm-hmm. This year I've been able to watch a little bit more, but I'm still trying to recoup. So, like, I watched UConn and I watched North Carolina a lot this year. Well, not a lot, not compared to what I used to. Those are the two teams that I kind of rooted for, and unfortunately both teams were pretty good. But it's always dangerous for your tournament bracket to
right.
Bracket.
Though I don't know. Those are two good heuristics just to have. Like, base rates say you're not going to go terribly wrong most years by loading up on UConn and UNC.
Yeah, it was pretty good this year, but I didn't do very well on a lot of the rest of it. But UConn looked like about the best team I've seen in years in college basketball.
Well, say more about that. So on the one hand, people said this is kind of a more open tournament than we usually see. On the other hand, they say the one that stands out is UConn. And so far, man, they've lived up to it. They have, I mean, there must be some examples, some precedent somewhere for how unusual it is to beat teams as badly as UConn has beaten teams over the last month.
Yeah, I was kind of wondering myself. Like, I mean, you know, I think we're used to kind of in a lot of like prediction models not using kind of score difference, because it probably is not all that diagnostic for most teams. But this kind of level of dominance seems to me somewhat unprecedented, at least in my kind of like anecdotal viewing like history.
Yes.
Well, I mean, hold on a second. We use score differential as all Pythagorean models are based on that.
So what were you talking about, Shane, when you say we're not used to using it?
Well, like, no, I more mean in like kind of like I would assume most kind of basketball, like most models of like kind of like, you know, predicting wins like team to team is like some kind of ELO thing where score differential is kind of intentionally left out.
You're saying in basketball you think that's the
Well, I don't know. I don't know. A is score differential predictive of future win probability? Let's grind that down. Wasn't my question, but that's worth knowing. And B, if it is it used in models, and is this a historically unprecedented set of score differentials?
And I think what we have with UConn, Ken Pomeroy, who has a great college basketball site, very cheap for a lot of people to sign up. He had UConn the best offense and I think the fourth best defense in all of college basketball. And those are adjusted by schedule strength. And it is mostly, net point differential is kind of the definer there when you adjust for strength of schedule. It is a very good predictor. You can probably do a little bit better if you get kind of play-by-play level and you identify those segments of time where, okay, UConn was winning by 40 and with
garbage
4 minutes
time
left to go, and they change their subs and that kind of thing. You can do that sort of thing. Yeah.
I've got a little.
I don't know.
Or I guess maybe let me ask a very specific question. Does kind of cleaning up against, like, during the regular season, dominating lesser opponents, and even in the early part of the tournament, dominating lesser opponents, is dominating them versus just beating them predictive of actual continued success in the tournament? That's the real question.
I can't
right?
speak to basketball per se, but in football, for sure, there's a lot of information in margin, and so much so that, you know, there are these years where there's a team that comes through undefeated. They barely win a bunch of games, and the narrative becomes they know how to win close games, and it's just BS. I mean, good teams beat other teams by a lot, and we've seen that, and I'm assuming it happens in other sports, but it's certainly the case in football.
There was something that I did like 30 years ago, just kind of looking at there is probably some point of diminishing, a significant point of diminishing returns, but it is instead of winning by 30, you should win by 29 or something
like that.
But
right.
And it's tiny. It's like, oh, okay. It's probably not real.
So some historical reference for what UConn is doing in this tournament, they have the highest cumulative margin of victory going into the Final Four this century. That makes it sound good, right? So the most since 1999, their cumulative margin of victory over the first, what would that have been, four games?
Four games, yeah.
111, plus 111. The record is Kentucky in 1993, 124. And there's a couple others in there. Duke
over presumably six games. It was
no, these are four. These are going into
the final four. Okay, right.
So it's great, but it's not unprecedented.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Top this century, but not unprecedented.
But they've got time to pile on. They've still got time to break. But
well, we don't know what these other guys.
Yeah,
did.
Yeah, I don't know where those guys ended up.
You could the tournament. Yeah, let's say that the tournament record is probably within sight still. Dean, what about on the women's side? And again, you are just a basketball fan, and with you know a fair bit of history across a lot of divisions, a lot of basketball you've seen. What do you make of what's going on with women's sports these days, and women's basketball in particular? So, for example, the ratings last night, the we haven't seen the official ratings, but the speculation from insiders was that the game last night between Iowa and LSU is going to top 10 million viewers. That's putting it up there. I don't know how many men's college football games top 10 million in a year, probably, you know, setting the postseason tight, regular season men's college football, I don't know, six or eight or something, I'm guessing. That's a guess, but it's not that many. Dean, tell us about women's basketball, at least your perspective on it.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of interesting to me to see the rise of women's basketball as a whole. I think WNBA also did a little bit better after some of the pandemic things too, and I don't know exactly why it's happening. I certainly like some of the style of the game. It's a little bit different.
Talk about that. That you'd be a very good person to talk about that. And it is interesting when you watch it. It does feel like a different sport, but a thoroughly enjoyable one. In some ways, it's even more enjoyable because the style is different. How would you characterize the style difference?
And you know what I would say is I'd say their decisions are quicker, a little bit more automatic. I mean, people say, oh, they pass the ball better. I think their decisions are actually just a little bit quicker. It's like they know each other better. Because I think in the NBA, maybe it's the defenses are more sophisticated. I'm not sure. You can always flip a lot of these arguments one way or the other. But when I watch a lot of the decision-making, I think, on the women's side, I think it's they know where each other is, and they can make those adjustments on the offense and the defensive side pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. That's a super interesting observation. Of course, the stereotype would be, is it too cliche? It is too cliche to say this, but do women just pass more? Is there more assist in women's basketball? I mean, the stereotype would be that gender differences in willingness to share. And do we see it actually play out on basketball? I know that's absurd.
Or, I mean, an alternative would be, I mean, what Caitlin Clark's doing, for example, is that's why we're kind of why we're kind of focused on it is what she's doing is sort of like unprecedented, and you know is like in maybe a sport where there's less of that just kind of unprecedented athletic kind of dominance. Typically, is teamwork kind of like really sort of like that much more kind of important?
Right.
Basically, coordination. Like you know, like I don't know enough to know whether or not kind of the coordination. Game, you know, like, you know, within the kind of game, within a possession, whether that is like more, you know, kind of, I guess, yeah, more cohesive in right. The women's sport versus the men's.
Well, that might explain.
Because you can't just dish it to LeBron and have him do something with it.
Right, exactly.
Typically.
If that's true, it might explain why Iowa is such a compelling team to watch right now, because they have both. They have an unbelievable athleticism and exceptional performance of Caitlin Clark, plus all the team stuff. And by the way, Clark does as much impressive. It's almost, her shooting is ridiculous. It's Steph Curry-esque. It's wildly impressive by itself. But then her passing is almost as impressive as her shooting. And it's both the traditional assist you see, you know, around the three-point lane, but also the long passes down court. She has some absurdly high percentage of her assists come from the other end of the court. They cross the midpoint line. It's an absolute ball to watch. It absolutely is so much fun.
So one of the things that I think has helped her and helped the women's game in general too, is that they're staying in school. I think that's something that we don't see in college basketball, obviously, as much. Some of the great players staying in school a long time. And when you have these players who are in school 3-4 years, and they get consistent minutes and they get consistent teammates and consistent coaching, you know what happens? Those decisions get a lot easier.
Yeah, right.
Decisions to shoot, decision to pass, what to do in certain situations. And I think that makes the game a little bit cleaner.
Absolutely. Well, it should be said, Angel Reese, at least as of last night, the star for LSU, hadn't announced what she was going to do, whether she might even come back for another year. But she was a real pleasure and very different way to watch. She's a low post player, and she's great around the bucket, and she gets it in the bucket from all kinds of difficult angles and just so much grace. And she's brutal on the defensive side of things. It was a lot of fun last night, and I'm sure the Final Four is going to be a ball as well. Dean, tell us more generally about what's going on with you. So you mentioned having come off the coaching side, which was different for you. You've been on the analytics side. There usually is a big divide in sports between the analysts down one hall, the coaches down the other hall. You go in on the coaching staff with the Washington Wizards. By the way, I quoted you. This is the week that you show up in my teaching slides. I have a quote in you. You may not know that I do this. You told me once that you spend something like 40% or at least 40% of your time when you're on the coaching staff, not doing analytics, but thinking about how to communicate analytics. So there's a book by a couple of guys, Chip Heath and his brother Dan Heath, and they divide our influential efforts between the getting the answer stage and the telling others stage. And they say the typical mistake is you pour all your time into the getting the answer stage and not enough time into how to tell others. And then you came along and said, well, I've been doing this for a while. And it turns out that I spent at least 40% of my time trying to figure out how to tell others. And I quote you in my slides to my MBAs this week, just for what it's worth.
It is true. And on the coaching side, it's potentially more. It depends upon kind of what you're working on. But for sure, a lot of coaching is teaching and communicating, and you're trying to convey it in different situations, either to the coaching staff or to the players themselves directly. And what you say and how you say it to them. And there's only so many things that you can prepare for. So you better be prepared at least how to communicate it. I've spent a lot of time, and different players have different levels of receptiveness. Different mm-hmm. coaches have different levels of mm-hmm. receptiveness mm-hmm. and different levels of interest. There were articles about working with Kristaps Porzingis mm-hmm. Last year mm-hmm. with the Wizards and how well that went, because he cared a lot about the numbers. And mm-hmm. so that makes it a lot easier, because if he can think in some of the more advanced numbers, then the communication on why this is a better choice, why taking this shot, not that shot, is better. You can give him an effective field goal percentage, and you can give him the idea that, oh, this is going to get you to the foul line more, that kind of thing. Whereas if you have to spend more time thinking about how to communicate it at a more base level, then there's less that you can convey. It's still, you can still do it for sure.
Well, you know, you're such an interesting person to talk to about this, because you have been in the business of communicating analytics your entire career. You've done it through books. You've done it on analytics staffs within organizations. You've done it for media companies, wildly influential in the way ESPN communicated their analytics, and now in a coaching staff. How would you say you've changed? Like, what's an example of a way that you've changed in your efforts to communicate analytics? How have you gotten wiser over that time? What wise advice can you give to the rest of us who are still getting better at communicating analytics?
Smile more. I think it's part of one of the things, frankly, is
I think you're being serious. So elaborate that a little bit.
Yeah, I think some of the day, especially when you're on a coaching staff and you're traveling with the players and the coaches for like 7 months and you're always together, sometimes you can wear on each other. So just being a positive kind of voice, even if you are directing people or giving people advice and things like that, just smile more, because it's like there's a lot of time to be serious, and you want to save those moments for when it is highly important. And you have a lot of time that you can convey. You just want them coming back to you. Mm-hmm. So actually, I think that is something. When I first started off in the NBA, I was super serious about everything. This is important. This is going to win us more games, and games means more money for everybody. All of this kind of thing. But you gotta sit back and enjoy the sport too. I mean, you frankly let yourself enjoy it, have fun with it, have fun with the people. And frankly, there are a lot of very interesting people doing this kind of job.
Well, it's a super interesting distillation you give. You want them to come back to you. I mean, that as a heuristic would guide a lot of behavior. So, yes, you want to get something across today, but you care a lot about the opportunity to get something across in the future, which means you want them to come back to you. That could change the way you go about things. That's super interesting. Dean, tell us a little bit about this topic you say you've been mulling and studying, motivation and demotivation. We roll into, you know, the NCAA playoffs and we see highly motivated players. We roll into the NHL playoffs and we talk about how we want to see the tracking data because we've been speculating for years that it looks different in the playoffs and especially overtime playoffs. I mean, you can tangibly feel it when you're watching these games. So we know at some level, at least we think we know at some level, that motivation matters. You've been close to the game. You've been thinking about this. In what way are you thinking about motivation and demotivation in basketball?
I've been fortunate to be in a few situations where I've seen more motivated versus less motivated players. For the most part, players are very motivated, very competitive. There are times, of course, they get tired, but and a lot of coaching staffs will say it's on the players. You got to bring your motivation. I can't do more than a couple motivational speeches.
Right.
All year. Like the players are going to wear that. So, but there are very simple situations like garbage time at the end of the game. Like when the game is decided and it's that situation where you're up 20 and there's 2 minutes left. Like, okay, you still have some starters in, but they don't play as hard. But the good thing you know is that some of these guys coming in off the bench, they are motivated. They're trying to impress the coaches. They want to make an impression that they can get more regular minutes, non-garbage time minutes. And so you can actually measure that difference in performance for some of those bench players versus the starters and how much the motivation then carries those bench players in those situations.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now knowing other situations where there's demotivation and motivation that may be going on, we try to see it with our eyes. We're not perfect at it. We think, like you say, going into the playoffs, everybody is hyper motivated. But how do we know that?
Right.
What can we see?
Right.
Identifying actions and stuff on the player tracking data, we haven't been able to see that yet. Maybe there's a sophisticated way to do that.
Well, so hold on. Stay there, Dean, because we this is what we've speculated and want to know. This is my and Shane's fantasy project since, I don't know, a meeting with the Flyers years ago where we spun up this idea that if you could tell us who the, quote, grittiest players are, like you just know you personnel people who the grittiest players are, we could then go get a bunch of tracking data and find markers of their behavior on ice that differentiate them from other people.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Dean, that you talked about talking about decisions, because I think when Cade and I have thought about this, or at least when I've thought about this, I'm actually more thinking about trying to measure kind of effort on the more impulsive behaviors. It's not so much the decision-making where I think you'd necessarily see the effort. It's like, given that you're going to a puck in the given that you decide to chase a puck in the corner, are you doing that faster or somehow with more measurable effort in a playoff situation or in an overtime situation versus kind of a regular season garbage kind of situation? So it's more kind of measuring it on like the more physical, like impulsive, like athletic level than it is. I think equally interesting but different question to think about the decision-making aspect.
But I'm with you, Shane, and you know, it's some of the most important stuff in basketball, like rebounding is an effort.
Yeah.
Effort stat. Conditional height, it's basically an effort stat. So anyway, so you said it's been hard to find these markers that Shane and I so glibly say that these people should find. So tell us more about it, because you've thought about it more than we have.
Yeah, I've thought about it. I actually asked a player. So Taj Gibson, who was with us with the Wizards last year, he's been in the league for a long time. And I actually asked him, and we talked about situations like diving for a loose ball. And he said there are some people who just do it to put on a show. And you have to kind of – and what he was basically leading me towards is that you have to know when there is – actually leverage, that's another word he used, but you can actually make a difference with this play. And looking for those plays and how often a player makes those plays, that is when they are potentially more motivated than normal, average. And it was a good conversation. I mean, because I point out sometimes when some of our players were criticized as they're not working hard this game, It was because they were confused, not because they weren't working. Okay. They didn't know exactly what to do in a situation. Not because they were confused about the game plan necessarily, but the other team fooled them. Okay. And so, like, oh, okay, who am I supposed to cover in this situation? It's not clear, and it looks like they're not working hard. Mm-hmm. But it's because they're just confused, the communication. How do you separate those things?
To be fair, you said it's not the game plan. And sometimes it is the game plan. This happens certainly in college football all the time. The coordinators put such a complicated system on some kids who they don't get that much time with. Defenses get really slow and unsure. So it could be what the other side does. It could be what your own coaching staff does. That's interesting, and that's a good caveat to everything, I think. So you're saying there's a judgment component, there's a clarity component. That makes a lot of sense. What about, you mentioned right up top, people vary on their competitiveness. I think one of the motivations for understanding motivation is if we can identify differences in players, especially differences in prospects. I mean, this is NFL draft season, right? So this is something that coaching staffs and the personnel staffs in the NFL are trying to figure out big time about these prospects. How much effort are these guys going to put into their training, to their play? Here's the question. How much of that comes down to competitiveness? If we really understood who the really competitive guys are, how much of that, how well would that explain the motivation that we observe?
Because what you're talking about is competitiveness. It's like this average level of competitiveness. Like Michael Jordan was supposedly competitive in every single thing that he did.
Right.
From like what he wore to what he drove.
Yeah, I guess it's right. I mean, what you're really kind of alluding to is almost like every athlete, I guess, has a competitiveness profile or portfolio that they can expand across various, you know, and there's people like, you know, Michael Jordan who can't turn it off. He just expends it no matter what the activity is type of thing. But maybe some other athletes, and this maybe goes to your more decision-making things, are more selective as far as how they expend that.
But that's all hypothesis.
Yeah.
I mean, it could be. I think that's the true lure in personnel shops is the guys that can't turn it off are the guys you want. Those are the ones who most reliably are going to be doing it in the weight room and on the field because they can't help but do it. I think that's the lure. I don't know if it's true or not, but I think that's the lure.
But I don't know. The whole thing sounds to me like you guys are having a lot of fun talking about this, but you're far away.
You can join in anytime. Thank you for joining in.
I'm skeptical because I don't think this is all that measurable. And I do like the idea that you would go to the players, the coaches, the strategists, and sort of set up a certain, you know, here are the people we think are motivated and then try to figure out what it is. But again, that also jumps the line, if you will, by, you know, there might be some, if you're able to define who's motivated and who's not, it's probably a real thing. There's probably based on something you're observing, but is it really connected to performance at the end of the day, right? So, I mean, there's all kinds of stories that we like to tell and people on the coaches that these things really matter. But can we measure it ultimately is what I'm asking. And obviously you're sanguine enough about it to start the project, but are you seeing anything that you can actually solve here?
Oh. And I think with basketball, with the garbage time situation, you certainly can infer an impact of motivation because you do see some of the changes and they're significant. I had a couple other situations where I knew it. Like there was a situation we had a player who all of a sudden started playing poorly. And I watched him over the course of like 5-6 games and he was really bad. And I started analyzing it for the coach. And I went into the coach to start saying, okay, he's playing poorly over the last couple of weeks and started walking through all the symptoms of what I was seeing. And the coach stopped me and said, well, that's when he started having some family problems. His girlfriend broke up with him. And so you see situations where these things kind of link up. These are just anecdotal kind of things. And there was a situation with the Nuggets when Carmelo Anthony wanted out, didn't want to stay there anymore. And there were trade proposals every day over the course of the season of who was going where with him, all of this kind of thing. And the players played worse. When the trade was actually done, the team got a lot better. And why did it get a lot better? It was because those players who were on our team originally got better, not the new players. It was the original players. And so I saw firsthand some of the demotivated players during that situation and how much better they got after the deal was done.
Well, one reason we might care is, and this goes to a classic difference we talk about in this show, we often talk about differences between players. And we might care because we want to identify those who run highly motivated, run highly competitive. A very different reason to care is we want to know how we can change the motivation within a player. That there are days, yeah. You're describing situations where, and Shane was talking about a profile of motivation, a profile of competitiveness. And it's probably the case, and this is the question for you. You've been around a lot of basketball staffs and a lot of basketball teams. How much variation do you see in coaching staffs, head coaches and others, in their ability to get players on the competitive, motivated side of their profile, like to move the dial within a player consistently enough to make a difference on the court? Is that a thing, do you think?
That is, it is. There is some variation. There's no doubt about it. And I remember reading some about it with football in some of the situations where, like, Tony Dungy actually inspired a lot of his guys. And he still couldn't do the motivational speech every week of the season, but he had the ability to make them feel like everybody was part of the team. You're trying to make sure you're keeping the egos from not blowing up the team and then the anxiety from the people who are on the bottom end from blowing up the team and just making everybody feel complete. And I think there are coaches that are much better at that aspect, but it gets very difficult to isolate that from other decisions that they have to make, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. personnel decisions, who plays, who doesn't, tactics, X and O's, those mm-hmm. kind of things. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to isolate those different effects without being kind of on the inside. Mm-hmm. And I was on the inside for essentially two coaching staffs, and I knew a bit about George Karl, what he did, but that's not enough for me to really comment mm-hmm. too mm-hmm. well.
We can anticipate Adi's protest. Adi's going to, he's just nodding. He's going to come in with the null hypothesis. He's going to say, you can't measure it, so you might as well not bother right now, which is fair. But look, man, don't rain, you know.
All right. All right. I think another way of saying that maybe is that, you know, I mean, I think we often use things like motivation or chemistry or momentum, these mm-hmm. nebulous, vaguely defined terms. Like, we kind of use them as, you know, we're like, oh, well, that's kind of the part we can't measure. And so we just sort of use those terms to kind of collectively discuss the residuals of a model. That doesn't mean they're not kind of, you know, the fact that they're not currently measurable doesn't mean they're not real. It's just you want to make sure that you're not just taking random residuals and interpreting them as a real thing.
That's right. And I want to emphasize, underscore, Shane just said not currently measurable.
Yeah.
One of the motivations, at least a rationale for indulging this conversation, is that this is the edge of analytics. Like, we will over time get better at measuring these things. But Adi,
well, I'm actually interested in this. I'm not dismissing it, because basketball in particular is an effort important sport. I mean, it's not baseball, which I'm happy to talk about later. We just sort of stand around. You're football, basketball, hockey, especially soccer. You got to budget, otherwise you can't get through it, right? And so that means there definitely is got to be variability on how to best use your effort. I mean, this is we've talked about with soccer with Messi. He knows how to walk. He's walking to conserve energy. You know, there are certainly basketball players who figure out how to do this. It's maybe one of the reasons why some players are really good on offense during the season, and then because they just need to, you know, husband their strength. And maybe there's a way to model that and figure out who's better at it, and et cetera. Or you can just say, it's all in the signal, right? And they do it well or they do it not so well, and you see it in their success rates.
Yeah, you see it in the actual numbers we can measure. That's interesting. But we're going to continue pushing the frontier and trying to get at it. We're going to have to let Dean go. But before you go, Dean, give us the preview on your book that's coming out this fall, Basketball Beyond Paper, as a 20-year later sequel to Basketball on Paper. What can we expect out of this book?
Yeah, the first book was very much about how we measure how good teams are, how good players are. The second book is very much more about what causes those things to change. What are the things from motivation to what kind of practice, what kind of drills, how do you fit players together? All of those things do have an impact on how well players play. And it's covering those topics. It doesn't have all the the details of how to measure these things as much, but some of the studies for what it means, what kind of things do actually help.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there, in your personal hierarchy, do you think do you have a favorite, or do you have something you consider relatively high on the list that because what I'm hearing is, you analysts, you don't have the whole picture. You know, we need to go beyond paper and numbers. There are these other factors. If you were to start at the top of the list, what would you point us to?
Well, I think motivation is huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, frankly, based upon what I was able to measure in those situations, it was enormous. And in both the anecdotal situations and then the study of garbage time, mm-hmm. those numbers were very high, mm-hmm. Much bigger than what I see in terms of differences in carrying out plays, like sideline out of bounds, baseline kind of out of bounds. I think we can do a lot better in terms of practicing shooting. I think there are some teams that already do that, and I think we'll get better with some of those, but those are tougher to actually test what we're doing working, because there's just, you don't want, a lot of people don't want to do experiments with yeah. the most high end shooters in the world.
Right. But they can do experiments in the G League.
Yes.
Baseball has always had the luxury of experimenting in the minor leagues. They haven't taken advantage of it enough. They have more recently lately, but basketball now has minor leagues. They can run experiments if they want to.
And Daryl Morey did that with the Rio Grande Vipers, I guess it was, there many years ago when they were just running like Loyola Marymount style for a few years.
Right.
They were able to experiment that. And I think different teams have different philosophies for what to do with their minor league team. And that limits some of the experimental
right.
stuff you can do that goes more broad than just the players.
Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, listen, Dean, thanks, man, for making time for us. Always a pleasure to talk to you. On the way out, tell folks where they can find you. We know that you're on Twitter at DeanO_Lytics, DeanO_Lytics. Where else can people track you down?
I'm there a lot for the most part. I'm doing some work with RoyceWeb.com. I'm writing articles there every so often. I actually did something on the impact of analytics on award voting over the last couple of weeks, just showing that it has made a difference in how people vote, that kind of thing. So those are the two principal outlets for me until the book comes out in the fall.
All right. Well, good luck getting the book out. We will look forward to talking to you more about it then.
All right.
Dean Oliver, longtime basketball analyst, book author, and friend of the show here. All right, team, that has been another Wharton Moneyball here on SiriusXM Business Radio. For the crew here, I've been in the studio for the last hour with Shane Jensen and Audie Weiner. Real pleasure. For Eric Bradlow in absentia, for Matty Datz, the boss man, Mr. Dion Simpkins running the show here in the studio. Great to be in the same place with you. Thanks for all the help. Thanks to you guys for listening. Come back and join us next time. Between now and then, enjoy your sports.